Welcome to the Florida Roundup, statewide edition. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Well, Tom, back in 2004, a Florida woman named Alethea Jones agreed to go with her sister Diane to buy drugs. It was supposed to be one last time.
And I was like, I don't want to do this. I really, really want to do. Like, I was just like 40 years old and ain't got nothing going for myself. Nothing. And that's sad to say.
Her sister bought $20 worth of crack cocaine from an undercover detective as Jones sat in the passenger seat. Now, Alethea Jones is serving a life sentence for her role in that $20 drug deal. Jones's addiction stoked the lengthy criminal record that the state used to put her away.
Melissa, now, the case is just one of the thousands of cases reviewed by the Herald Tribune newspaper in Sarasota. Investigative journalists there analyzed millions of court and prison records in Florida, finding differences in how Floridians convicted of drug crimes are sentenced based on their race. Black defendants are sentenced to two-thirds more time behind bars than white defendants for felony drug crimes, according to the investigation. Michael Bragg is investigations editor for the Sarasota Herald Tribune. Josh Solomon is the investigative reporter on the series for the Sarasota Herald Tribune. To both of you, welcome to the Florida Roundup. Josh, let me begin with you. Was it clear from the data that the difference in sentencing was related to race?
Yeah, I mean, as it pertains to, you know, drug crimes in Florida, you know, we poured through, you know, over a decade's worth of data, and this is for every county in Florida. And what we saw time and time again were that African Americans, you know, were receiving longer prison sentences, you know, for the same drug crimes under similar circumstances as white defendants. And, you know, you guys mentioned Alethea Jones, and, you know, no bigger example than her, you know, in terms of the cases.
Josh, I'll have you speak up just a little bit on the phone here. The assistant state attorney that is in the location with the Alethea Jones case sent a written statement saying the prosecutors would proceed differently if the Jones case came before them today. So what what makes up that difference? She was sentenced to life for crack cocaine.
That's correct. And what they did was they basically sought enhancements as a habitual offender. You know, which they were able to do, and with that, then the maximum became life in prison. So, you know, essentially they're saying under their new state attorney who just took office in January that had this case come before them today, they likely would not have given Alethea the max. I mean, would they still habitualize her? You know, would that mean 3 years or, you know, 8 years, which is about what her sentencing guidelines would have dictated, or would it have meant 25? You know, they haven't specifically said that, but you know, clearly, I guess they do also believe that this was a overly punitive sentence,
And it's the Florida Roundup, our look at news from across the state. We want your calls wherever you are in Florida, and here's our question to callers right now. What's your reaction to the investigative work in the Sarasota Herald Tribune that shows, if you're a person of color in Florida, you are much more likely to do a harsh prison sentence than a white person if you're convicted of a drug crime? And so, Michael Braga, we need to go back to the 1980s and the war on drugs when the crack epidemic was raging in this country, particularly in African-American neighborhoods. But now, more often than not, drug issues in many neighborhoods have to do with opioids, drugs like heroin and fentanyl. And more often than not, in this state, like many others, the people dying and doing the drugs are Caucasian. Still, though, as your data shows, police still tend to disproportionately target African Americans and other minorities. Have you had any response from lawmakers to your investigation and that disparity that we see?
Well, lawmakers, you know, are behind this. I mean, there's a number that want to lower mandatory minimums or do away with mandatory minimums. And so there are a number of lawmakers who are going to react to this and are going to propose legislation that will address these concerns. Opioid crisis, it really is a white crisis. I mean, mean, 9 out of 10 of the people dying are white. So it's no wonder right now that the system is paying more attention to white defendants and giving them more access to treatment. But the system should be fair. Just because meth and crack are less lethal doesn't mean that people addicted to them don't need that help. Instead, they tend to lock those people up that are taking those drugs, and they tend to be poor, and more often than not, they're black. When crack was the rage, blacks were never given treatment, and that continues today. And I think that there is a feeling that blacks aren't considered redeemable.
Well, like Alethea Jones, the only hope she has of getting out of prison is a pardon by the governor. Is that right? And she's never received any rehabilitation.
Yeah, that's correct. That's right. I mean, you know, at the time, you know, when the emphasis was crack cocaine in minority communities, again, the answer was not treatment. You know, today, the answer is increasingly seen as treatment, and that's a good thing. You know, treatment works. We know that. But then access does need to be equal. You know, there are still out there people who are being arrested for crimes, you know, related to crack or even marijuana, you know, and they're being put behind bars. And we're just not seeing the same response, you know, when it comes to a lot of these white defendants who are, you know, getting arrested on opioid crimes.
We think that people give up on blacks faster than they do on whites. And you see that throughout our series.
But by people, do you mean judges?
I mean, prosecutors and judges, and they tend not to. It's easier, for instance, lawyers all over the state were telling me that it's easier for them to get somebody off or get somebody drug treatment for opioids because the prosecutors and the judges understand how somebody can get hooked on opioids after they've hurt their arm or something, and then you know, and then get addicted to these drugs, but they say to me that they can't understand how somebody can get addicted to crack. I guess part of it has to do with the fact that opioids were legal drugs initially, right? Mm-hmm. And that crack is illegal. But I think it has a lot more to do with, you know, why on earth is that black person taking crack? Who could possibly do that? It's like a more of a disbelief, whereas they're, when they see their own selves in the defendant, they're more likely to give them treatment rather than punishment.
Justice is supposed to be blind, but we're talking about the investigative series One War, Two Races, coming to us from the Herald Tribune media organization in Sarasota, speaking with two of their investigations folks, Michael Braga, the editor, investigations editor for the Herald Tribune, Josh Solomon, the investigative reporter behind the series for the Sarasota Herald Tribune, finding wide disparity between drug sentences in Florida between black defendants and white defendants. Statewide, you can call us. Do you have any experience with criminal justice when it comes to drugs in the state of Florida? 305-995-1800. Have you found yourself or a family member or loved one as a defendant? Have you found yourself as a member of a jury on any one of these cases, for instance? 305-995-1800. Josh, what did you find in terms of location? Are there counties in Florida that have wider disparity in these drug sentences than others?
Yeah, absolutely. And we believe we're going to have some follow-up work coming out on that. But, I mean, you look at areas like Miami, like Orlando, where you have a larger metropolitan city, maybe more resources, you see a lot fairer sentences. You know, Miami actually, you know, is credited as having the first drug court. So their drug court is a model to look to. But then you look at other areas, maybe some more rural areas, you know, some areas that tend to be a little more so-called tough on crime. Those are the areas where you really see the widest disparities. And you see some of that in the Panhandle, in our area, up in Jacksonville area, you know, those kind of areas.
Right. I noticed in your report you found that in Jacksonville, where I'm broadcasting from, in North Florida, judges in Jacksonville will sentence a white person convicted of drug-free zone enhancements to an average of 644 days behind bars. A black defendant convicted of the same offense gets almost three times longer a prison sentence. Were you able to drill down more into that data to find any other possible justifications for that much more punitive sentence for an African-American for the same offense? Were there any other contributing factors, or is it chalked up simply to racial, systemic, implicit racial bias?
I think it is systemic racial bias. I mean, in Jacksonville, 30% of the population is black, but blacks represent 60% of people convicted of felony drug crimes. So immediately, from the police, you have more blacks being arrested for drugs than whites. So that's the start of the bias. And then as you move into the system, you had a prosecutor up there, Angela Corey, who was very tough on crime, and tough on crime often translates to tough on blacks. She's gone now, and her successor is changing things. But you know, she's still dealing with a lot of the same staff that they had before. And then you can look at judges too. I mean, some judges up there are more harsh than others. We looked at one judge, Hulsey. He was the one who said that all blacks should go back to Africa, allegedly. And he had wide disparities in terms of blacks and whites. He sentenced them blacks to much more time. But a guy like Russell Healey, he's a much more fair judge. And he he got involved in the plea bargains. If he didn't like a plea bargain, he would throw it out. He was really active, and because he was active, he was more fair.
Michael and Josh, we want to get to some phone calls here, but I want to follow up, Michael, on the role that judges play and the sentencing rules that they have to follow. What kind of leeway do they have to fuel the kind of disparity that you've documented?
Well, actually, it goes back a year before. We published a series, Biased on the Bench, that looked at similar racial disparities. We were able to drill much deeper this year. But what we heard time and time again from judges was, hey, look, it's not us. You know, we're not responsible. A lot of these sentences are the result of negotiated plea deals. That's the prosecutor. That's the public defender. That's the other parties involved. You know, and as we took a deeper dive back in, we see, yeah, you know, everyone in the system is responsible, and that includes judges who sign off on these. You know, even in the Alethea Jones story, you have sort of the judge in that case sort of pushing some of the blame to the prosecutor, and you have the prosecutor sort of attributing it back to the judge. So even within the same case, you can see how, but really it was decisions from both sides that led to the differences, and we're seeing that across Florida.
But we are seeing that judges who are the most confident and the most versed on the law tend to be the ones, and the ones that get involved in plea bargains, that suggest things in court, that suggest that this person shouldn't get away without any prison time, that leads. If a judge leads, it tends to be fair.
And if you're just tuning in, it's our Florida Roundup, a look at the biggest headlines from around the state this week. 305-995-1800. What are your thoughts about this story out of Sarasota? But it's looking at drug sentencing across the state. Let's begin with Lilas in Fort Lauderdale. Lilas, you're on the Florida Roundup. Good Friday afternoon. Go ahead.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to say I'm a former prosecutor, and it really depends, like you said, the judge and the prosecutor and how they look at different crimes and, you know, the severity of what happened. But also, I think what, I don't know if your researcher had looked into this, but the Florida legislature has a scoring system for the crimes. You know, any felonies carries a certain point. System, and that value, if it's over 44, is going to equal mandatory prison time. So sometimes the white folks didn't have the priors that would kick them up, and sometimes the black people had, unfortunately, a lot more crimes in their history, and that's why they got a worse sentence for the same offense.
Lilas, Michael and Josh,
thanks for that. What about that?
Well, first of all, that's absolutely true. We did find that often blacks were given longer sentences, were given more points at sentencing. But then you have to ask, you know, what charges were they charged with initially, and what charges were dropped? What we find so very often in these cases is that like, for instance, people who were caught selling drugs or buying drugs within 1,000 feet of a school or a church or whatever, are given an enhanced sentence. And far more often blacks are given those enhanced sentences than whites. And so there, it's kind of a chicken and the egg problem. Are blacks being charged more, which means that their points are higher, which means that they're going to get longer sentences? We see so often where the white defendant was charged initially with selling 1,000 feet from a school, but then that was wiped away. That's the prosecutor does that. The prosecutor wipes that charge away.
Yeah.
And what that does is it will greatly then influence the points that you end up with at the end of the day. But to also answer the question, we did actually indeed control for the points. And what we did was we did weighted averages. So we made sure that we were measuring defendants who had similar points at sentencing, indicating that the severity of their crime was similar, as well as their backgrounds were similar. So absolutely, we know any type of sentencing study that doesn't take into an account a defendant's record isn't very good. So we were absolutely able to control for that and had several.
Gotcha. Okay, and let's do one more quick call. It's Randy on the line from Sarasota. Go ahead, Randy, quickly.
Hi. I think the whole issue of imprisonment versus treatment emerged from the privatization of prisons in the United States, which was consistent with the rise of the crack cocaine epidemic in the 80s, same time the private prison system emerged. Of course, it's race-based, and until a lot of these young white children and their parents and other relatives started overdosing, they fell at loggerheads with the private criminal justice system. They even had a collusion, the big word today, with prosecutors and crooked attorneys and
all right, Randy. Yeah, I've got you. And we're short on time, Randy. So let me get Michael and Josh to react to this quickly. The profit motive in all of this, Michael and Josh, getting more bodies into private for-profit prisons. What about that?
Well, I think that that's, definitely in terms of imprisonment, that's a problem. The real problem is we don't have enough treatment facilities now on the treatment side. And that would be, would be great if the governor would approve, Medicaid expansion, then we could have many more treatment facilities and then there wouldn't be a waiting list for people who are trying to get in these. So, yes, the prisons, the private prison factor is there, but we need more money on the treatment side.
Michael Braga is investigations editor for the Sarasota Herald Tribune. Josh Solomon is the investigative reporter for the Sarasota Herald Tribune. They collaborated on One War, Two Races, an investigation in the Herald Tribune newspaper. To both of you, thank you for joining us on the Florida Roundup. You are listening to the Florida Roundup statewide edition today from Florida Public Radio.
Welcome back to the Florida Roundup, our statewide edition. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville.
And in Miami, I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. Congressional Republicans are finishing rewriting their massive plan to overhaul the tax code, trying to wrap that up today, adding in a significant expansion here, Melissa, of the child tax credit aimed at boosting benefits for low-income families throughout the United States.
That's right, Tom. And they made that 11th-hour change primarily to meet demands from one man, Senator Marco Rubio. Rubio threatened yesterday that he would vote against the bill unless that credit was expanded. And that has injected last-minute chaos into the whole process. Just a moment ago, CNBC reported that Rubio will vote yes on the measure, although his office has not yet confirmed that.
Kelsey Snell is NPR's congressional correspondent who joins us now from the U.S. Capitol. Kelsey, what do we know about Rubio's vote? Any change?
So Rubio's office is not responding to requests for comment on the change to the bill. Some of his other colleagues who were similarly asking for an increase in the portion that is refundable of the child tax credit say that they want to see the entire bill before they pass judgment. And we won't see that final bill for several more hours. They plan to release it publicly at 5:30 p.m.
It's 305-995-1800 to join the Florida Roundup. Kelsey, Marco Rubio was tweeting about this yesterday, and he essentially framed the argument as a zero-sum choice. Whether you want to weight the package for the well-off over the neediest Americans. And with these tweets, he sounded a lot more like Democratic members of the Senate than Republicans, frankly. But hasn't he been consistent for quite some time now on this issue of the child and family tax credit?
Yeah, so Senator Rubio and Senator Mike Lee of Utah both said that they introduced a version of this legislation back in 2015. And so they have been talking about the child tax credit for many years now. So it's not surprising that he has made this a major issue. And, you know, he also began calling for the refundability portion to be expanded way, way back at the beginning of this process.
And so is this a win for Senator Rubio? In other words, in a win for Floridians?
Well, I'm certain Senator Rubio would say that it is a win. it's hard to judge in that way specifically. It would mean that lower income people would be able to see benefits from this. So the distinction that they're trying to make here is that if it is not refundable. So if people cannot get a direct check from the IRS for the portion of the child tax credit, then low-income people who don't necessarily have a taxable income aren't going to benefit. So say you're a middle-class person who already owes the IRS money. It is helpful for you to have this $2,000 credit no matter what, because you are owing the IRS money. But if you don't owe the IRS money, if you expect to be getting a check at the end of the year or in April when you file your taxes, you need the refundable portion for you to see any benefit at all.
Kelsey, it's interesting to look at the polling on this issue. More than three quarters of Americans say they see the tax bill as benefiting the wealthy over middle and lower income citizens. So certainly Senator Rubio has seen that polling. But how concerned is Republican leadership overall? When you look at this bill's unpopularity, it's drawing protests in D.C., outside lawmakers' offices. It's not something that has broad popular support.
Sure. They say that people will like the outcomes of this tax bill when they start to experience them. I've talked to many Republican leaders who say that they feel that the public is being given misinformation or the public doesn't understand, and that the true test will come when people see their tax bill at the end of the year, or they see a bigger refund, or when they file new W-2s. Those are the forms that you file when you started a job. Well, people are going to have to file new ones once these new tax brackets are released. And so they're expecting that once people file those new W-2s, they will see a little bit more money in their paycheck as the result of cuts in rates. So Republicans feel confident that people will change their minds.
We are speaking with Kelsey Snell, the NPR congressional correspondent, with us from just outside the U.S. Senate chambers as last late-minute work continues on the compromise between the House and Senate versions of the tax reform tax legislation package. Kelsey, still expected a two-chamber vote next week on the compromise?
Yeah, the idea right now, the plans have shifted just a little bit, and the exact timing is probably still in flux. But the idea is that the Senate would probably vote first, maybe on Tuesday, and then the House could pass the bill probably by Wednesday or Thursday. All of that stuff is a little bit shaky. We won't really know exactly when until next week starts. It's mostly dependent on scheduling when people can be available to vote on this.
And let us know, callers. Go ahead, Tom.
305-995-1800 is that phone number all across the state of Florida, 305-995-1800. You know, oftentimes politics has been described as the art of the possible. If that's the case, Kelsey, and Senator Rubio has flexed his senatorial muscle here to be able to get what he thought needed to be in there for his vote, the child tax credit, what's the compromise?
Well, the trade-off here, we don't know yet. We don't know how they're going to pay for this. It was an expensive addition, and we still don't know exactly how they, you know, what they will be doing to trade off, how they will be changing things. There are a number of options out there that they could make changes to the rate structure. They could increase rates for somebody. They could make some of the tax breaks expire sooner. So we won't know any of that until 5:30 when we see the bill.
And as you count the votes, Kelsey, we're watching several senators who could make the difference up or down. For example, like Senator John McCain of Arizona, he's in the hospital fighting cancer. His health status could change from week to week. And the Senate majority is a little slimmer for Republicans than it was a few days ago after Democrat Doug Jones beat Roy Moore for that Senate seat in Alabama. And so how shaky is the vote tally on this as you try to count the votes that might be on the margins, like Senator Rubio's could go one way or the other? Although we are hearing some media outlets are reporting that he will vote yes.
Yeah, so if Senator Rubio votes for this bill, and if Senator Lee joins him in voting for this bill, we really only know of one or two other people who were even leaning towards being skeptical about it. That's Senator Bob Corker of Tennessee, and potentially, though I think she's probably going to vote yes, Senator Susan Collins of Maine. Now, the Senate can afford to lose two votes, and then that would put them at 50 votes for Republicans, and then the vice president could come in and break a tie. It's not inconceivable that they would lose one or two people and that the vote from the vice president would be necessary, but I don't see any indication that they will miss that number if Senators Rubio and Lee decide to support this legislation. It's important to note that Doug Jones will not be sworn in time for this vote. He will not likely be sworn in until at least January, because there's a process that needs to happen at the state level. It's called certification, and the Secretary of State in Alabama said that that takes time. There's a survey that needs to happen, and he just will not be, that it can't happen in time for Doug Jones to join.
And that's what I was going to follow up and ask you, Kelsey, Tom, whether Democratic demands to seat Doug Jones in time to vote on this measure would be listened to. But Kelsey, you just answered our question on that one. So that's a bit of a sideshow to the overall weight of this bill, which is going to reshape a big chunk of our economy. But what about, too, the criticism that it's being rushed through? Of course, that's what Democrats are saying. Republicans are charging back. Well, look, you rushed the Affordable Care Act through and didn't give us enough participation in that process.
Well, this is quite different than the Affordable Care Act. This is going much, much faster. The Affordable Care Act process took several years. And I am, as we are sitting here, getting reports back from Democrats who say they still have not seen this bill. The Democrats who were on the conference committee, which its job was to combine the House and Senate bills, but Democrats were not included in that process, and they have not seen it. And I'm under the impression from at least the House and actually now from the Senate Democrats that I've been corresponding with that they don't expect to see the bill before 5:30 when the rest of the public is able to see it.
All right. Let's go to a few calls from anywhere in the state here on the Florida Roundup. What do you think about the tax bill in Washington? It's 305-995-1800. Nick is in Jacksonville. Hey, Nick, go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to refer to the comment earlier about how a lot of the senators and congresspeople believe that the public will be behind the bill once it's been passed. Doesn't that kind of contradict their actual job of listening to their constituents, and they're just essentially saying that they know what's best for us as opposed to listening to what their constituents actually want?
All right, Nick, thanks for that. Kelsey, is that an argument that's getting through up in Washington?
Well, they say that people are misunderstanding what the bill would do, and that Republicans continue to reiterate that many people will see a tax cut. They say that all people across income brackets, they will not say that every person, but that middle class people will get a tax cut under this bill. They're saying that is primarily because it would double the standard deduction that most people take. That means individuals would be automatically able to write off $12,000, and married couples would be able to automatically write off $24,000. And they say that that would eliminate the need for most people to go through and have all of these additional bits and pieces of deductions that we call itemizing. So they say it'll be simpler for a lot of people, and most people will get a tax cut. And they said that, you know, people just don't understand that.
Just to show you how far this tax deduction has gone, even my 12-and-a-half-year-old was asking me about tax itemization the other day. Not at dinner,
that's a smart 12-year-old.
Well, I may have to have him to do our taxes this year. Nalisa is joining us on line 3 from Miami. Nalisa, thank you for joining us. Your thoughts?
Hi, I'm specifically calling because the whole purpose of the bill is economic development, or like to bring income and economic growth to the United States. But what I think that Senator Rubio has done is placed a focus on youth in particular, and that is the thing that will unite the entire nation together because they are absolutely the future. And focusing on low-income youth is the most important thing. And Secretary Acosta said himself, Labor Secretary from Trump's administration, said there's plenty of jobs, there's not enough training or focus on them. So focusing on health is a requirement and a prerequisite before actual development, and a focus on low-income communities saves us all in the United States on a more equitable playing field.
Now, Lisa, that's a great point. Kelsey, as Senator Rubio was making his thoughts known earlier this week and yesterday, kind of floating the threat of possibly a no, was he making that kind of plea to his colleagues?
You know, one thing that we do know that he has frequently said about this is that, you know, that he does think that children need to be taken care of very specifically in the tax bill. And that while this legislation is weighted very heavily towards having tax breaks for corporations, he did say that he thought the tax bill needed to pay more attention to individuals and to families.
We'll continue to watch this. As you said, Kelsey, there's still could be more ins and outs and changes before this passes or maybe doesn't quite make it through the process. I think you have to stay pretty close to it, don't you? Because there could be another 11th hour change, right? Real quick.
Well, once this is filed at 5:30, then that is it.
That's it.
The House and Senate have to pass identical bills, and there will be every effort made to make sure that this passes as is.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for joining the Florida Roundup. We really appreciate you being on the show with us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Kelsey Snell is NPR's congressional correspondent. She joined us from the Capitol to discuss that tax bill being debated right now. And you're listening to the Florida Roundup. It's our statewide edition from Florida Public Radio.
Climate change could cost local and state governments more to borrow money in the future. And in low-lying Florida, Melissa, sea level rise may put pressure on government budgets as they look for money to hold the water back. Now, this week, the bond rating agency Moody's released a report warning if local, state, and the federal government don't adapt to climate change, the risks will grow and likely become more expensive to
fix. That means it's more expensive to all of us, Tom, the taxpayers. And that got us to wondering, how are Florida cities and counties spending their money right now to adapt to climate change as the costs continue to rise later? Well, we decided to ask one guy who works on that very issue for one big Florida city. He's Chris Castro, Director of Sustainability for the City of Orlando, and he's on the line. Chris, welcome to the show. And first off, what's your reaction to this Moody's report on the cost of climate change and on government budgets?
Pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for the opportunity. You know, I think the Moody's report certainly makes things a little bit more apparent that there is no doubt the U.S. faces some significant and diverse economic risks to climate change, many of which we've talked about, including sea level rises and the increased damage to storm surges, and especially what we found out here in Florida after the recent hurricane season. You know, Florida cities and county governments are really trying to figure out what are those economic risks of climate change that we're facing today and into the future, and what are ways in which we could mitigate and adapt to those as we move forward.
And you are doing quite a bit in Orlando. Can you tell us a little bit more about your sustainability efforts through that city's GreenWorks program?
Most definitely. About 10 years ago, Mayor Buddy Dyer launched the GreenWorks Orlando Initiative, really focused on how we can take climate action and become the most sustainable city in the Southeast. And as a result, we've been working on a wide variety of areas. First and foremost, we have pretty ambitious greenhouse gas reduction goals. We are looking to exceed what the Paris Protocol is trying to reduce of 90% greenhouse gas emissions compared to 2007 levels by the year of 2040. And, you know, what was interesting is earlier this year, over 380 mayors across the entire United States, representing 68 million Americans, committed to upholding the Paris Climate Agreement and doubling down on that by joining what's called the We Are Still In Coalition. Orlando was one of the first cities to join that effort and really figure out ways in which we can adopt more energy efficiency policies and programs, so making significant investments in our own buildings. And we've saved over $2 million over the last 2 years annually of reducing our energy consumption. Secondly, we're trying to figure out how to drive more renewable energy. And just earlier this year in August, we passed a policy to move Orlando towards 100% renewable energy, both for municipal operations by 2030, but also citywide by mid-century 2050. And I'd say the last major way that cities are looking to meet these goals is fuel transitions. A lot of us are moving towards electrification and incorporating more electric vehicles, but also compressed natural gas vehicles for our large solid waste trucks and our fire trucks, and even testing all electric buses within the downtown Orlando core to see how we can move towards a zero emission bus transit system for the public.
Chris, it's Tom Hudson. Those are all kind of responses to the underlying causes of climate change, certainly, and greenhouse gas emissions. But what about the impact from? I know the coastal communities here in South Florida, and I know also St. Augustine, Melissa, in your neck of the woods in North Florida, they're dealing with the impact of it. The conversation isn't so much about energy transfer, although it is there. The conversation is instead about stormwater pumps, seawater, sea walls, brackish freshwater contamination, the real impact from climate change.
That's correct. Yeah, there's a really great report that was recently launched. It's called the Risky Business Report. It's really the economic case for investing in climate change. And what the report really looked at across the Southeast is the coastal properties and infrastructure that would be needed to be invested. And what they found was that the total price tag for hurricanes and other coastal storm impacts could be as high as $35 billion over the course of the next 15 years, something that has significant impacts, obviously, on our bonding effects and public spending. And so coastal properties down in Miami and St. Petersburg,
Chris,
but also in Orlando, are facing some of these infrastructure
We've
challenges.
Got to leave it there. Chris, we thank you for your time. Chris Castro with the City of Orlando. You are listening to the Florida Roundup Statewide Edition from Florida Public Radio. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup, the statewide edition today. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Well, Tom, in November, when the Brevard County Commission began its meeting, it was business as usual, with the local pastor offering an invocation.
So just lead us in prayer, please.
Oh, thank
Everyone
you.
Stand, please.
Well, thank you for the honor, and let us go to the Lord in prayer. The Lord be with you. Amen.
But a month later, this month, it was a different beginning to the government meeting.
Hi, good evening to you. It is the first meeting in December, and we're glad to have you here today. We have a quorum, so I call this meeting to order. Our first order of business would have been an invocation. Mr. Knox, do you want to go ahead and let us know why we're not doing an invocation tonight and just doing a moment of silence?
Mr. Knox, there is Scott Knox. He's the Brevard County Attorney. Now, he explained at the beginning of the December meeting, the moment of silence was the commission's only option since a federal judge had ordered them to stop having a clergy member deliver prayer before their meetings.
That's right, Tom. A U.S. district judge ruled that the prayer violates both the U.S. and Florida constitutions. Dave Berman is government editor for Florida Today, and he joins us now. Now, Dave, not surprising, this whole thing began with a lawsuit. Can you tell us who sued over this issue of invocation at the meeting and why?
Yes, it was a group of atheist and agnostic and humanist organizations, and they filed the lawsuit in 2015. And a year earlier, they had asked to be part of the invocation process, where they would be part of the rotation to give the invocation. But the county commission rejected that request, and a year later they filed a lawsuit.
Sure. And often this issue of sectarian prayers at these local council or commission meetings versus what some groups call a more inclusive prayer, this comes up in municipalities around the country where different groups insist that the prayer is too sectarian or that there should be no prayer at all. There have been a lot of complaints and lawsuits all across the country. How does this lawsuit compare? And since this is before a U.S. district judge, what sort of precedent could this set, if any? What's going on in Brevard County?
Right. The lawsuit was filed claiming that the U.S. Constitution and the Florida Constitution were both being violated by them not being allowed to be part of the invocation rotation. And the county commission did offer them an opportunity to file a speaker card and speak a different portion of the meeting. But the groups that filed a lawsuit felt that that was not the same thing, and they filed a lawsuit. Now, the case now, the U.S. District Judge ruled in favor of these organizations, and now Brevard County government is planning to appeal the case to a court of, a federal court of appeals. So this case could have pretty wide implications for the area that that court of appeals would cover if the groups were, if the decision was upheld for those groups.
We're speaking with Dave Berman, government editor for Florida Today, about a federal judge telling Brevard County that it can no longer begin its regular county commission meetings with a local pastor offering an invocation. What about Christian prayers before government meetings? Is that something that you would support, or do you think it should end or at least be changed as the case here that we're talking about today is being adjudicated? 305-995-1800, prayer, invocations, government meetings right now on the Florida Roundup statewide. Your thoughts, we'd love to hear them. 305-995-1800. 1800. We've seen sports teams, for instance, Melissa and Dave, prayer before athletic events. We've seen, you know, other kinds of organizations hold moments of silence. Dave, for Brevard County, how long has this practice gone on, and is it systemic? In other words, is it institutional that it is reserved for a Christian pastor?
Well, the practice of having invocations, I've checked back, and it goes back at least to the 1970s that they've had pastors or other clergy people give the invocations. And they're not always Christians, but the vast majority are Christian, and often the message has some Christian part to it where Jesus is mentioned or some other Christian reference is mentioned. But they've had pastors and clergy people from other religions do the invocations occasionally. The issue now is that with this court ruling, there's an injunction against the county giving these invocations.
Right,
and they can't do a prayer at all.
Mm-hmm. So no prayer at all. You know, it's interesting to note that when you research this issue nationwide, some governments have opted to do a moment of silence because it's such a divisive issue. Some municipalities sue. Let's take a quick call. John in Jacksonville. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, hi. How are you doing?
Good. Go ahead.
I applaud their efforts. I think it's a much-needed change. It's been far too long that Christian prayer has been honored as the singular invocation, and I think either offer diversity to everyone, including atheists, or go for the moment of silence and allow people to make their own choice of how they want to begin that meeting.
And so you've seen, John, here in Jacksonville, for example, it depends on who the city council is, how they handle this issue, as I've noticed over the years. Thanks. That's John in Jacksonville giving us a call about that. And he supports the decision. You're listening to Florida Roundup on Florida Public Radio. Okay. Let's go to Dave Berman again quickly. Dave, you said this could set a precedent. What about this one commissioner in Brevard saying that this violates our freedom of speech as Christians? Of course, not everyone that the commission represents, though, is a Christian.
That's true. And the commissioner that said that, she didn't say it at the meeting, but when I asked her about it afterwards, that's her thoughts about it. And she does work for a Christian church in addition to being a county commissioner. And she feels that in the Christian community, there's some outrage about this, and they feel that there is the speech of the Christian community is being reduced because of this. But then, on the other hand, the groups that have filed the lawsuit feel their rights have been violated by them being excluded from giving this message. And many other communities in Central Florida, they have made the same request to city councils and county commissions, and they have been allowed to be part of the invocation on an occasional basis.
Was there anything institutional within Brevard County? In other words, was this, you know, written into the official rules of order about how to conduct a county commission meeting?
I don't believe it was written into the rules, but it was more a tradition that this has been going on for years and years, and every meeting started with an invocation and the Pledge of Allegiance.
Bring in another call here. The Pledge of Allegiance still stands, I imagine, in Brevard County with the commission meetings. The judge didn't tell them to stop that, did they?
No, they still do the pledge, and they do them right after a moment of silence.
Quick call, Coconut Grove in Miami. Mark, you are on the radio. Thanks for holding on.
Sure, thank you for having me. I agree with the decision completely. I mean, I don't think there's a place for religion in this sort of government proceeding. They pretty much, I think, in my opinion, have an option of either removing all prayers or being completely inclusive, which means that we'd have to rotate in Jewish prayers and flying spaghetti monster prayers and anything else that somebody might have in mind.
Gotcha, Mark. Appreciate it. I want an opposing opinion coming from also the Magic City. Luis, you are on the radio. Your thoughts, Luis.
Yes, thank you. I was wondering about all these groups that are going against this, about the prayer. What's going to be next? Are they going to go after the dollar so we no longer have God written on the dollar or all the coins, and have all the coins remade, because now all of a sudden you can't mention God? Is that going to be next?
Luis, we got you here. I appreciate that. There's always that slippery slope argument here, Dave. But just to be clear, the federal judge didn't rule necessarily about the God mention. It was more about a religious exclusivity when it came to this invocation with this county commission. Is that fair to say?
That's right. They said that they could have, they didn't say that the invocation was improper to have one, but they said it has to be inclusive, to include the atheist, agnostic, and humanist groups if they want to continue doing the invocation.
Well, as you said, Dave, this is a closely watched case. It could have ramifications on a lot of government meetings around the country, including many bodies here in Florida. So thanks so much for joining us today with your coverage of this story.
Well, thank you for having me on the show.
Yeah, we really appreciate it. That's Dave Berman. He is government editor of Florida Today, and we're following that case after a U.S. district judge ruled that sectarian prayer was not constitutional. Well, finally this hour, Tom, cops and Santa Claus. Yes, they do go together up here in Northeast Florida. It's called the 904 Secret Santa Program. Some Duval and St. Johns County deputies were very busy this week handing out envelopes to random people. But tickets weren't inside. Guess what was inside? $100 gift cards. In all, they delivered $50,000 of those cards to spread the holiday cheer. The money, Tom, it comes from an anonymous donor.
It's a really cool program, Melissa. Down here in Miami-Dade, police are not handing out gift cards.
Too bad.
But they're not handing out as many tickets as they used to either. So, that's a nice thing. But it's not because of St. Nick and the holiday spirit. It's because the Miami-Dade Police Department is running low on paper tickets, believe it or not. Those ticket booklets, they're running out of. The department is moving to electronic tickets, and the system has just been delayed.
That means Tom will evade any moving violations for the next few weeks.
You can park your sleigh anywhere, Melissa.
That's our show today. The Florida Roundup is produced by WJCT Public Broadcasting in Jacksonville and WLRN Public Media in Miami. Gina Jordan and Kevin Murchard are our producers.
Jason Zapka, our technical director. Peter Mertz, our program director. And our theme music by Miami musician Aaron Libos.
I'm Melissa Ross.
And I'm Tom Hudson. Have a great weekend.